Welcome to the DreamWork Summit, where you'll discover a unique variety of DreamWork approaches and ways to open to your inner guidance from leading DreamWork experts, renowned psychology professionals, and inspiring authors. Share this powerful event with your friends and family, and join in our conversation on Facebook at The Shift Network. And now your host, Susan Audrey.
Greetings, everyone. I'm delighted to introduce Dr. Sharon Blackie, an award-winning writer whose work beautifully weaves together psychology, mythology, and ecology. Her highly acclaimed books, including The Enchanted Life, Unlocking the Magic of Every Day, as well as her articles and courses, focus on the development of the mythic imagination and the relevance of our native myths, our fairy tales, and folk traditions on the personal, social, and environmental problems we face today. Welcome, Sharon. It's such a pleasure to have you here with us.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be talking to you as well, Susan.
So Joseph Campbell said the dream is the personal myth, and the myth is the collective dream. How is a myth a collective dream, and what is mythic imagination?
Well, Campbell, along with many other researchers in his day, was really talking about a collective dream in the human sense, that myth is part of the collective human dream. And I suppose I'd really like to say up front that my own approach to this kind of work is actually to try and get out of our own heads as a species, and to take myth out of the purely human setting and put it back into the land where I believe that it comes from. So Jung, for example, talked a lot about the collective unconscious, and he was talking very much about the collective human unconscious, again, putting it all back on us, as if we are the ones who create the myths and who create the stories. But to me, what I'm really interested in is more of a collective kind of planetary unconscious. I'm interested in all of the consciousnesses on this planet and the way that myth interacts with them. And I don't just mean animals, I also mean trees, rivers, stones. It's kind of what Plato might have called the soul of the world or the anima mundi. So it's kind of like a collective planetary unconscious rather than just us.
Thank you for that. That's a beautiful explanation. And in terms of mythic imagination, can you give an example of how we can work with that?
Well, yeah, let me just clarify, I suppose, what I mean by mythic imagination and why it matters that it isn't just human. Because to me, the mythic imagination is important because it is a way of connecting us back to the planet, back to this world and the land from which we as a species have become so profoundly disconnected. And I guess that's why I'm stressing the fact that it's not just our imagination, it's kind of a planetary imagination. So if I can just explain briefly, there is some ancient Sufi thought from the ancient Islamic tradition, and this is more relevant than it might appear, where they believed that there were several worlds layered on top of the world of the intellect and the physical world of our senses, which we can see. And one of these worlds, they believed, was called a French scholar called Henri Corbin, who studied this philosophy, called the Mundus Imaginalis, or the imaginal world. And Corbin believed that in the imaginal world, all of the stories and all of the images, all of the archetypes, all of the myths actually lived and had some kind of independent existence. So this is a completely contrary idea to the idea of most modern psychologists, which would believe that the stories literally come out of our heads. Corbin, the ancient Sufis, and modern Jungians like James Hillman, very much believe that they had an independent existence. And if we were very lucky, they might actually happen to us. They might in some way interact with us. And in that way, they can be a bridge between us and the land and the planet that we, as I say, have gradually become so very much disconnected from.
And you had some beautiful examples of this in your book, If Women Rose Rooted. From your own experience with the land, can you share a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think my own experience of place came about, a very deep experience of place, came about when I lived in on an island, really in the farthest western reaches of the United Kingdom, in the Outer Hebrides. And there was literally nothing between us and this continent except an awful lot of sea. It was at the end of what was called the longest cul-de-sac in Europe. And because there was nobody very much else there, certainly nobody that I really had anything very much in common with, I was thrown back really on the land and on the myths and stories of the land for my deepest relationships. And that was a place really where I started to learn about the stories that arose from that particular land. In particular, the stories of the in Gaelic mythology, in Irish and Scottish mythology, an old woman called the Cailleach, who created and shaped the land. And stories about her were everywhere in that part of the world. And so I delved into those stories very deeply. And it was very much, she was very much a character that was imminent in the land. So you would find, for example, that there were elements of the landscape that were named after her, that specific stories about her were attached to specific places. And so that really taught me the ways in which places and the stories that arise out of places can become so important to us to create a very, very deep sense of belonging to those places. And that to me is very much what the area of the mythic imagination that I am interested in, that's what that is all about. It's about how we can tie ourselves back into our places, into a relationship with our places, through knowing the mythic characters and the stories that are associated with those places.
You're so good at telling the stories. Can you share a short one with us that would illuminate some Celtic symbology or mythology?
Yeah, I suppose one of the stories that has always struck me, and it's quite a short one, is a story that I shared right at the beginning of If Women Rose Rooted. And it shows us really how very profoundly our relationship with the land matters. It's a very ancient story, probably the oldest story in the body of work that we now call the Grail mythology. Most of us know about the Grail mythology was actually written down in the 13th century onwards, mostly by French and then later some German poets. But before that, it had a long history, both in the written tradition and in the oral tradition. So this story is a story that only occurs once in the literature, and it's a story which tells of the UK, or rather England and Wales at that time, which was known as the land of Logres. And Logres was a very beautiful land. The land was in good heart, it was fertile, crops were very fine and plentiful, people lived in harmony with the land, the tribes were happy and peaceful. And there were two reasons why this was the case. One is that in those days, the otherworldly court of the Fisher King could be found in that kingdom. And it was that court that all of the beautiful things of the world came. So not only plentiful foodstuffs, rich silks and clothing, fabrics and so on, but all of the beautiful wild things of the land, all of the birds, the wolves, the bears, the deer, all of the beautiful wild things of the land also came from the court of the Fisher King. The second thing that was responsible for the land being in such good heart and people living in harmony with it was a network of sacred wells. And these wells were guarded and tended by maidens. And these were otherworldly maidens because the sacred wells contained water which flowed up from the other world. And this was the life-giving water. It's the water that gave life to the land. And the well maidens tended the wells, and they had another function, which was that if any traveler should come by a well who was in need of food or drink, they would offer him food from their golden, from a golden platter, and a drink of well water from a golden grail. And all went very well until a king came to the land whose name was Amangon. And this was a king who did not understand the contract between the people and the land, between the people and the sacred wells. And he didn't understand that hospitality goes both ways. So Amangon one day happened upon a well, and the well maiden came out to offer him food and water. But that wasn't what he was interested in. Amangon took the well maiden. He threw away her grail and her platter. He threw her over the wall of the well, and he raped her while his men looked on. And seeing what the king had done all around the country, his men began to do the same. They raped the well maidens one by one until the maidens no longer came out of the wells, and the life-giving water of the other world ceased to flow, and the land became a wasteland, so that all of the fields grew brown and parched, all of the trees shriveled and lost their leaves, and the beautiful otherworldly court of the Fisher King could no longer be found in the land of Logos. So I love that story because it tells us that the other world, which is very much associated with the land in Celtic mythology, is the source of life. And the other world in Celtic mythology being very like this concept of the Mundus Imaginalis. You know, it's a place where magic lies, where stories happen. It's a place where synchronicities happen, where dreams are born. And it tells us that if we don't tend it, if we don't respect that otherworldly power energy, then something gets broken between us and the land. Our relationship gets broken.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for sharing that. It, you know, I can see for myself, but I'd love for you to speak to it. How do you feel myth jars us and awakens us to these things in ways that, say, a news story about what's actually happening today doesn't? I mean, I know the answer to that, but I'd love for you to speak to that.
Well, part of it, there are a number of reasons for it, I think. Part of it is that these are ancient patterns. You know, they're not just something that somebody has sat down at a computer and typed up in the way that many of us would write fiction today. They're ancient patterns, and I believe that they really do exist as independent entities outside of us, just as I believe that dreams are independent of us and they happen to us. And because of that, I think it is a way in which the anima mundi, it's a way in which this earth is trying to get our attention. It's trying to communicate with us. And so the myths and the archetypes are one of the ways where it can get our attention, because they're designed really to capture our imagination. And when I was a practicing psychologist, I haven't been for a good few years, I'm much more focused on writing now, it was very clear to me that if I wanted to help the people that came to see me achieve some kind of change or transformation, I had to find a way of capturing their imagination. Otherwise, it wasn't going to work. It wasn't going to last. And what myth does, because it comes out of this imaginal world, it's kind of designed specifically to capture our imagination, to go right to the heart of us. So yeah, these are ancient patterns. They're designed to wake us up, really, and to draw us into a deeper understanding and a deeper relationship with this beautiful animate earth.
Thank you so much for that. How would you recommend that our listeners start to work with their own mythic imagination? What are some of the first steps they can take to delve into this wonderful realm?
Well, there are lots of different ways of achieving this. I mean, people who work specifically with dreams, and that's not the major focus of my work. The major focus of my work is much more on myth and story. But, you know, this concept of the imaginal world would have it that dreams also come from there, and that in dreams we see characters, we see archetypal mythic situations, which again are ways of this world trying to communicate with us. And so by working with your dreams, exploring the images and the archetypal characters, the archetypal situations and landscapes which appear in our dreams is one very clear way of exploring the mythic imagination. But stories also are very important in this, and sometimes more accessible, particularly to those who don't dream well. And so I would say, think about the stories that really have captured your imagination, particularly if there are any stories when you're a child, because I think we're much more open to these things when we're children. Not everybody heard fairy stories when they were children. But if you did, and there are particular fairy stories that you loved and that have stayed with you, it's really very interesting to start thinking about why that is. So one of the stories that stayed with me from being a child was the old story of the Wild Swans. The Grimm's brothers had it, Hans Christian Andersen, everybody has some version of it. It's the story, very briefly, where a young girl's seven brothers are turned into swans by a wicked stepmother, and in order to transform them back to men, she's told by an old woman she meets in the woods, of course, that she must pluck nettles with her bare hands, spin the nettle fibre into yarn, and then knit shirts. And when she throws the shirts over, the brothers, you know, then they will transform back into men. And that stayed with me for such a long time from when I was a child. And it's a story that I still work with. And it has so many different themes. It has themes of endurance. It has themes of recognizing the magic in a plant that we often think is just a weed. It has themes of the animal side of us, that shape-shifting into a swan or some other animal and what that means. So there are so many different symbols and images that I can explore in that story that it provides all kinds of fodder. It means that when I look at a swan, I don't just see a swan, although I do absolutely see a swan. A swan is a very beautiful thing. I know it's, you know, I know what it's for. I know its place in the world. But I see a kind of layer of other things on top of it. I see layers of that story. I see an image of the seventh brother, because the young girl doesn't manage to finish the seventh shirt in time. And he is always half man, half swan. And I wonder what that means, to be half animal. When I look at a nettle, I see something very fine that I can make into soup or tea, but I also see a symbol of transformation, you know. So again, it's kind of like, if you look at the world in this way, it's kind of like a set of layering images on top of an everyday object that really catches your imagination and draws you into relationship with it. So to think about those symbols, to meditate on them, to draw them or paint them, if that's what you do, to sew them, to do needlework, if that's what you do, to write about them, if that's what you do, to just explore them in a very gentle way, and what they might mean to you and what they might reveal to you over time. These are the ways in which we can bring ourselves in relationship to the myths and stories, which particularly are poking at us and saying, hey, look at me, listen to me. I'm the one you want to think about.
You've done a lot of writing of myth and story, and how is that process helping you with your own transformation?
I think it always has. I don't remember a time when I wasn't taken by story, and in the days when perhaps I wasn't quite as attuned to the land that I live on as I am now, I would say that that was very much my way of feeling my way into the world. And it sounds like a contradictory thing, really, because, you know, we often think of stories as escapism, you know, as getting inside our own heads and kind of like protecting us from the world. And indeed, they can be that. But I never really saw it as that. I always saw it as a way of illuminating what things in the world were. So, you know, a story, many of the Irish stories, for example, many of the old Irish myths have women goddesses particularly who shapeshift into crows or ravens. And what that always told me was that there is a wisdom that a crow or a raven has that we don't have access to. You know, that there is nothing that separates us from a crow or a raven, that if a goddess wants to shapeshift into an animal like that, then clearly there's something pretty special about that bird. And so it the stories made me actually look at real live animals, real live plants, in a different way, to look at what they can tell me, what they can teach me. Because I always believed as a child that the stories are real. And when I came across this this old ancient Sufi explanation of the Mundus Imaginalis, it was like, yes, that's it. That's what it's been all the way around along, that these stories really are real. And they're trying to do just that. They're trying to prod us, to poke us, to capture our imagination, to tell us to look again at the world more deeply and show us what we can learn from it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. You had mentioned to me before we started the interview that you're working on a new book. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes. My latest book, of course, is The Enchanted Life, which is only just a couple of weeks ago out in the United States. And that was very much about these practical ways of capturing our imagination, engaging our imagination, working with myth and story and other things to so that we can live a life that is more attuned to the world around us. But now, after two non-fiction books, I'm going back to fiction for a little bit of a break, and I'm finishing a book called Foxfire Wolfskin, which is a set of retellings of old myths and story tales, fairy tales about shape-shifting women, not just in the Celtic tradition, but in a bunch of different traditions around the world. So again, that's proving very interesting because it raises that question of what would it be to be something between a woman and a heron, for example? You know, what would that show us? What does that tell us about different ways of being in the world or different ways of seeing the world? Shape-shifting stories are stories of possibility, and that's possibilities, the main thing that has always interested me.
What are some of the favorite symbols or shape-shifting images that you're drawn to?
I think very much out of the Irish tradition, I'm very drawn to women as herons or cranes. I should say that cranes and herons are interchangeable in Celtic mythology, because when the crane became extinct, the grey heron moved in to take its place. And it's very, very similar bird, even though they're very different species, similar in behaviour and so on. So we tend to look at them interchangeably. And there are many, many old stories about old women, particularly old hags, who are very powerful old women who are associated with cranes or herons and who will shapeshift into them. And these women are, they're not to be messed with. They're fairly fierce. They often guard the gates to the other world. And I'm particularly fond of a thread of the Celtic mythological tradition, which offers us up very fierce old women. Because I think that is something that we very much need for the times. I think we need good role models for what it is to be a fierce but nevertheless loving and caretaking female elder. And I don't think we're necessarily finding them in contemporary society. And so it's very interesting sometimes to go back to the old stories. So I mentioned earlier on the Calliope, the old woman who created and shaped the land, who was very important to me when I was living in the Outer Hebrides and still is today in Ireland. She, as an archetypal character, is very much a guardian and protector of the land. So she is shown almost as a spirit of the wilderness, you know, whose natural place is on the top of hills, where she's shown dancing across the hills with her staff, and when she strikes the ground with her staff, winter comes, and she sometimes is portrayed riding on the back of a wolf, followed by a herd of wild pigs or wild deer. But there are many stories about her, especially in Scotland, appearing before hunters who are about to, for example, shoot a female deer during the season where they might be pregnant, and saying, "No, you may not. You may not take one of my female deer. You can shoot a stag, and if you leave the females alone, I'll allow you to take a stag." So it's very much a kind of balancing act, you know, a kind of antidote to the human tendency to take too much. And again, that kind of very fierce old woman who's not, you know, she's not doing any harm to the hunter, but it's very, very clear that she is not having it. And again, I think for the times, for an age of ecological crisis, I think those are precisely the images and archetypes that we need.
I love that. You're so right. That totally is what we need right now. I'd love for you to share about, you have a school called the Hedge School. Can you tell us what you teach?
Yeah, Hedge School, by the way, for those who don't know it, it's a word, it's an old concept which originated in Ireland. And when Ireland was around about the 16th, 17th century, when yet again it was invaded by the English, and the English tried to stamp out both the Irish language and the ancient forms of education, which were bardic in nature, as well as teaching maths and science and that kind of thing. They also taught poetry and the old stories, the old sagas, the old myths. And the English were trying to put a stop to this and force everyone to go to their schools where they could only speak English. And so the Irish literally took to the hedges. So they had hedge masters who were learned in all of the old Irish ways and the myths and the stories and the poetry. And they had what they called hedge schools. You know, they would meet sometimes in the outdoors, sometimes in an old barn or whatever, and they would teach the people. They would teach the people what they were not allowed to hear from the establishment. And so, in a sense, my hedge school is very much about that. It's about teaching a different form of wisdom, a kind of hedge wisdom, which is the wisdom which really comes from the edges in difficult times like this. So it's about going back to old ways of interacting with the world. It's about going back to the old stories, to the old poems, which tell us how to live in balance and harmony with the land, and which provide us with some of those wonderful role models like the Kalyuk, which can inform our ways of being in the world today, even though they're very ancient.
Mm.
So we offer courses, online courses, retreats, and next year, next spring in Ireland, we have our first weekend festival called Hedgewise, which will be exploring this very interesting issue of how we can focus in on ancestral wisdom, not to hark back to what our ancestors did 2,000 years ago, but to try to bring it back into contemporary times and see what it can illuminate for us today. So we'll be exploring all kinds of ways of doing it.
Well, you've brought us so much wisdom during this session. Thank you so much. And before we go, I'd like to remind our listeners that if you'd like to have this full recording with Sharon and all the recordings from the DreamWorks Summit interviews for your own home library, you can find out more by going to thedreamworkssummit.com/upgrade. That's thedreamworkssummit.com/upgrade. And before we part ways, Sharon, is there one last thought that you'd like to share with our listeners about mythic imagination?
I think it's really what I would really encourage everyone to do in whatever place they are living now, the place where their feet are planted, whether you love it or don't like it, whether you think you'll be there forever or whether you're just passing through, I'd encourage everyone to go and find out about the old stories that are associated with that place. So, if it's in Europe, and then there'll be plenty of stories of our ancestors there. If it's in America, of course, there will be stories of Native peoples who were here before us. And obviously, it's important to treat those stories with respect. But those stories will shed some light on the archetypes and the images which are present in the land that you're actually on, and which will enable you maybe to find a way into a deeper sense of relationship with it. So yeah, go out and find the old stories and see what archetypes might be alive and well right now in the place where your feet are actually planted.
I love that. Thank you so much. And thank you for your time today. It was just a real deep pleasure. Thank you, Sharon. And thank you to all of our listeners.
Thank you. It was a pleasure for me too.
Thank you for joining us for the DreamWorks Summit, brought to you by the Shift Network. You can add every teaching and transcript to your personal library by visiting thedreamworkssummit.com/upgrade. To learn more about awakening to your full potential, and together co-creating a world that works for all, visit theshiftnetwork.com. Thank you again for joining us and for sharing this life-changing information with your friends and family.